Chapter 8. The First Whale Hunt. One morning, not long after the events I told you about in the last chapter, I heard a strange story from a seaman who had been on watch the previous night. The sea had been calm, and there had been silence all over the ship, except for the regular sound of sails moving in the light wind. In the silence, he and another seaman had heard noises under the deck near the stern of the ship, where seamen did not usually sleep.
"We heard someone cough," the man said. "Then we heard the sound of movement as if people were turning over in their hammocks."
I stared at him in surprise.
"I tell you, Ishmael," he went on, "there are people who we have not yet seen on this ship. I think Ahab knows all about them."
It became clear to me in the following days that Ahab had realized something that he had not considered before he spoke about his plan. It was possible that the crew might mutiny if they thought they were not going to earn any money by catching lots of whales. Now, Ahab kept telling the lookouts to
sing out for a whale,
so they knew they would still get a good payment at the end of the voyage. One hot, still afternoon, I was sleepily helping Queequeg with some work on a whaleboat when there was a shout from Tashtego, high up on a masthead. It was a shout made by all whalers when they saw a spout blown high up into the air.
"There she blows! There, there, there! She blows! She blows!"
He was pointing into the distance like a prophet who has seen something that no one else can see.
"Where? Where?" many voices cried.
"About 2 miles away. There's a group of sperm whales!"
Immediately, the ship was busy. Ahab changed the Pequod's course so it was sailing straight for the whales. Another sailor took Tashtego's place at the masthead so that Tashtego could join the crews who were preparing the whaleboats. There were 3 whaleboats which hung over one side of the ship, ready to be lowered into the water. There was also a 4th one, an extra one, which hung on the other side of the ship in case one of the others was damaged. There were other boats in the hold in case they were needed, because sometimes boats were wrecked during whale hunts. Suddenly, every man stopped what he was doing and stared at Ahab. A group of 5 men who seemed to have come from nowhere, as if they were ghosts, stood near the captain. It was while the surprise ship's crew were staring at these strangers that Ahab cried out to one of the group,
"Get the other boat ready, Fadala!"
A tall Indian man with long white hair wrapped around his head led the group to the 4th boat. All of the men were Asian, and they were wearing black cotton jackets and trousers, like many Asian people do.
"The boat is ready," the leader said a few moments later.
He spoke in a whisper, which sounded like the noise of a snake.
"Lower the boats!" shouted Ahab.
He shouted so loudly that his amazed men immediately dropped the whaleboats into the sea and jumped off of the Pequod's side straight into them. I have never seen any seamen more skilled than those on whaling ships. Ahab himself jumped into the stern of the 4th boat, and his boat joined the other 3. So these are the men who made the noises the 2 seamen heard one night, I thought. And maybe they are the ghostly shadows I saw near the ship in Nantucket Harbor.
"Captain Ahab,"
said Starbuck. But Ahab stopped him speaking, telling the mates responsible for the whaleboats to move them away from each other. His boat went ahead of the others, with the new seamen rowing together so fast and so hard that they were like a machine. There were hurried conversations between the mates and the men about the 5 strangers.
"They must have come on board before the ship sailed," said Starbuck.
"Yes, yes," said Stubb. "He hid them below. I think he wanted extra men to hunt the white whale, but didn't want to ask the ship's owners for extra food and money. Oh well, the more men there are, the easier it will be to catch whales."
and in this way, my first whale hunt began. I was one of the six men in Starbuck's boat. The four small boats, only about 30 feet long, were perfectly organized for the hunt. Starbuck stood at the stern of our boat, and four of us sat in the middle, two on each side, and rowed. Between us were the mast and the sail, which Starbuck controlled. Queequeg stood near the bow and rowed with the long harpooner's oar. He had two jobs, to row and to turn and throw a harpoon when the boat was close to a whale. His harpoon was attached to the line, the long piece of rope which was coiled into a wide wooden barrel in the middle of the boat. When a harpooner hit a whale, the line would run out over the bow with great speed, causing a lot of danger to the crew. Sometimes there was more than one harpoon attached to the line. After a whale had been harpooned and pulled close to the boat, the harpooner became the helmsman, and the helmsman went to the bow. It was the helmsman's job to throw lances at the whale in order to kill it. I watched with interest how the three mates managed their boats very differently from each other. Starbuck did not speak often, and when he did, it was in a kind of loud whisper. Stubb, smoking his pipe, talked to his crew all the time, sometimes shouting, sometimes encouraging, sometimes making jokes. And Little Flask was never still, at one time standing on the shoulders of his huge, tall harpooner, Dagoo, so that he could see ahead of his boat. I thought Flask, with his white blonde hair, looked like a snowflake on top of Dagoo's blackness. Ahead of the boats were the whales. No ordinary men could have said where they were, but these skilled whaling men looked at the patterns on the water and knew exactly how to find them. Suddenly, Tashtego, in Stubb's boat, bent down, saying hurriedly,
"There they are! There they are!"
"Pull, pull, my good boys," said Starbuck, in a whisper which all of us heard. All the boats rushed on, following the whales. The rowers did not look over their shoulders to see where the whales were. It was their job only to listen to the helmsman and use their arms. The four small boats were driven up huge waves where they stopped for a moment on the very top as if they might break into two pieces. Then they slid down into the valleys between the waves. The Pequod sailed on behind the little boats as if she was a mother duck chasing her ducklings. The sights and sounds and feelings were amazing to me, someone who had never hunted a whale before. The sky began to get darker, and the wind began to get stronger, and as we got closer to the whales, the water rushed in all directions. The boats moved further apart as they chased different groups of whales. Suddenly, our boat rushed into a wall of fog so we could not see the other boats.
"Stop rowing, men," whispered Starbuck,
pulling the sail tighter so the boat rushed faster over the sea.
"There's white water again. There's a whale ahead, and we can catch it before a storm comes."
Then there was another whisper.
"Stand up."
And Queequeg, harpoon in his hand, jumped to his feet and aimed his harpoon.
"That's his hump. Now, now," whispered Starbuck.
There was a rushing sound as Queequeg threw the harpoon. Then suddenly, the boat shook violently. The wind pushed it forward at the same time as the whale pushed it upward. It was as if there had been an earthquake under the boat. The whole crew fell into the wild sea. The storm had arrived. The harpoon had hit the whale but not stayed in its body, and the whale had escaped. There was nothing wrong with the boat, except that it was full of water. We managed to get our oars and get back into the boat, but we could not row because the boat was full of water. We shouted and shouted, but the men in the other boats did not hear us. Then it began to get dark as night fell. All night, wet and shaking with cold, we sat in the boat and hoped to be rescued. When dawn came, there was still fog all around us. Suddenly, Queequeg jumped to his feet with a hand round his ear. As we all listened, we heard the noise of the movement of wood and rigging getting nearer. Then the fog lifted for a short time, and we saw the huge shape of the Pequod coming straight toward us. Terrified, we all jumped into the sea and watched as the ship crashed into our whaleboat, wrecking it underneath her. Again and again, we swam toward the Pequod and were carried away by the waves. But at last, the crew pulled us out of the sea. The other men had managed to get back to the Pequod before the storm and were looking for broken wood or lances to prove we had been drowned. "Queequeg, my friend," I said, as we stood wet and shaking on the deck of the Pequod. "Does this sort of thing happen often?" He nodded his head. I turned then to Stubb, who was calmly smoking his pipe in the rain. "Mr. Stubb," I said, "is it normal for a whaleboat to get hit by a whale in the middle of a storm?"
"Yes,"
came his answer. "Mr. Flask," I said to the third mate, who was also close to me, "do whalemen always row backward toward the open jaws of whales?"
"Yes," replied Flask. "You can't row forward toward a whale, can you?"
Having gotten these answers from these three whalemen, that night I wrote down what would happen to my things after I died. Queequeg signed the piece of paper with his mark. If I died, Queequeg would get everything I possessed.